is Wednesday, May 20th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Samsung Electronics and its union are holding last-ditch talks after the union announced earlier today it would go ahead with an 18-day strike over bonuses. More on that in news briefing. On Wednesday Election Watch, we turn to Gangwon and the Chungcheong regions, looking at key races, local issues, and what the polls suggest 2 weeks before voters cast their ballots. In lieu of Korea Trending, we'll be discussing the 2026 World Conference of Korean Adoptees, currently underway. And on Korea Book Club, we're talking Cho Ye-eun's Teddy Bears Never Die, a dark, funny revenge thriller featuring an axe-wielding teddy bear. Let's start Korea 24 right now. Samsung Electronics' largest labor union announced earlier today that it was going to proceed with a planned general strike on Thursday after marathon negotiations with management collapsed. The union said that it had accepted a mediation proposal made by the National Labor Relations Commission, but that management didn't budge. Then, just a couple of hours ago, the two sides met in another last-ditch attempt to try and iron out their differences with help from the government. For more on this and other headlines of the day, Rosine Park from the KBS World Radio News Desk joins us now. Hello, Rosine.
Hello, Alana.
Rosine, labor and management at Samsung Electronics are holding another round of negotiations on the verge of this 18-day general strike that's expected to start Thursday. Give us the latest on this.
Yes, well, Samsung's largest labor union announced that workers were going to proceed with a planned walkout following the collapse of talks earlier Wednesday. Then in the afternoon, the labor ministry revealed that the two sides were going to hold a meeting mediated by the Minister of Employment and Labor, Kim Young-hoon. The talks began around 4:25 p.m., as we know, at the Gyeonggi District Employment and Labor Office. The union wants the company to abolish the cap on bonuses set at 50% of annual salaries, allocate 15% of annual operating profit to bonuses, and institutionalize the bonus structure. But Samsung Electronics said in a statement earlier that the union had insisted on what it called unacceptable demands that could damage the company's management principles. Now, if the strike is launched as planned, involving around 48,000 workers walking off the job over the course of 18 days, the impact of that action could shave up to a half percentage point off South Korea's economic growth this year, according to an analysis by the central bank.
And Rosine, we have heard today from the presidential office regarding the situation at Samsung amid mounting concerns that this strike is going to go ahead. What exactly did Chung Hwa-dae say?
Well, before the latest meeting came about, the presidential office earlier expressed deep regret after the 2 days of negotiations between labor and management failed to close a gap, despite the government's mediation efforts. Chung Hwa-dae officials said they hope both parties will make every effort to reach an agreement while taking into account the potential impact of the planned strike on the nation's economy. And hopefully that's what's happening right now.
And of course, the labor ministry has also expressed hopes that the two sides can come to a compromise. They've vowed full support to that end. Give us the details there.
Yes, the labor ministry, as you said, also vowed full support for Samsung's labor and management to settle differences through voluntary negotiations to avert a massive strike. We heard from ministry spokesperson Hong Kyung-ri today, who stressed that producing a solution through dialogue between related parties is the dominant principle. Now, when asked about the possibility of the government invoking its emergency arbitration powers, Hong said it's too early to talk about that and just reiterated that there's still time for those voluntary talks.
Well, of course, we will be closely watching to see if labor and management can reach a compromise before that planned strike is set to go ahead on Thursday. Moving on now, the government has revealed that a South Korean ship is passing through the Strait of Hormuz, where it had been stuck amid the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. What do we know about this ship?
Well, according to Foreign Minister Jo Hyun, a South Korean-flagged oil tanker is passing through the Strait of Hormuz following consultations with Iran. He gave this update to the National Assembly's Foreign Affairs and Unification Committee. This marks the first passage of a South Korean ship in the key waterway since the war broke out. The ship is named Universal Winner and it's carrying crude oil. It was on its way from Kuwait to Ulsan when it became stuck in the critical maritime choke point. We know it's one of the 26 South Korean ships that had been stranded in the strait due to the conflict.
And Rosine, did the minister say just how much oil cargo is on the tanker? And of course, do we know when it's set to arrive here?
Joe said the vessel is transporting 2 million barrels of crude oil worth some 300 billion won, or roughly 199 million U.S. dollars. It sounds a lot to us, but relatively considered a small amount. But at this point, every drop counts. Based on data from global ship tracking site Marine Traffic, Universal Winner was passing through the Strait of Hormuz at around 2:30 p.m. Wednesday. That's Korea Standard Time. It is scheduled to arrive in Ulsan sometime around June 8th. So that's a little less than 3 weeks from now.
Well, meanwhile, in international waters, another aid flotilla headed for Gaza was intercepted by Israeli forces. Among the activists on the boat was a South Korean who the government is now trying to get back home. Give us the details.
Yes, the government has requested Israel to swiftly release and deport a South Korean activist named Kim Ah-yeon, who was aboard a Gaza aid flotilla that was seized by the Israeli military. Seoul has said that it's been continuously asking Israel through various channels to ensure the swift release and deportation of South Korean nationals if boats carrying them are captured. The foreign ministry in Seoul said it's working to get Kim back to South Korea. She reportedly needs to get a travel certificate via the local embassy in order for that to happen.
And I understand that there was also a Korean-American activist that was detained.
Yes, that's right. The Korean flotilla for a free Palestine said it confirmed that the French flag Lina al-Nablusi, the vessel that was carrying Kim, was also carrying Korean-American activist Jonathan Victor Lee. Their boats were seized by Israeli forces in waters near Gaza at around 2:50 a.m. Wednesday, Korea time. This comes again after another Gaza aid boat, the Kyriakos X, carrying South Korean activist Kim Dong-hyun, was intercepted on Monday by the Israeli Navy in waters off the coast of Cyprus.
Turning now to Seoul-Washington affairs, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Allison Hooker is expected to visit South Korea in the coming weeks to launch bilateral working groups to implement agreements reached during last year's South Korea-U.S. summit. Rosine, give us the details there.
Okay, well, the U.S. State Department on Tuesday disclosed details about the planned visit in a press release, and that was regarding the results of a meeting held in Washington between Hooker and South Korea's first vice foreign minister, Park Yun-joo. As we know, South Korean President Lee Jae-myung and U.S. President Donald Trump, they held summit talks last October on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit held in Gyeongju, where they finalized the terms of their trade, industrial cooperation, and security alliance. Now, according to that, key points of the security agreement include U.S. support for South Korea in building nuclear-powered submarines, as well as an expansion of South Korea's authority to enrich uranium and reprocess spent nuclear fuel. So that's what these group meetings may also include. According to the department, Park and Hooker discuss efforts to advance the broad and enduring Seoul-Washington alliance, and they also reaffirmed the importance of ensuring the freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz and in global waterways.
And marking a bit of a turn in inter-Korean affairs, a North Korean women's football team is currently making a rare visit to South Korea. Unification Minister Chung Dong-young talked about this during a parliamentary committee meeting today. What did he have to say?
Yes, Minister Chung said setting a good precedent is a goal of welcoming those North Koreans, the Naegyo-hyang Women's Football Club, to South Korea. He made the remark during a full session of the Foreign Affairs and Unification Committee when asked how the ministry will link this latest visit with future inter-Korean relations. Earlier on Sunday, the North Korean team arrived in South Korea for the 2025-26 Asian Football Confederation Women's Champions League semifinals against Suwon FC Women, and that game is currently underway in Suwon right now. Jung said the AFC sent him a letter and asked for cooperation for the semifinals to be carried out as a pure international sporting event that puts aside political situations. The minister said based on that request, he decided not to attend tonight's match.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thank you so much, Rosine, for bringing us the headlines.
Thank you for having me.
It's now just 2 weeks until the June 3rd local elections and National Assembly by-elections, and Korea 24 is once again taking a closer look at the issues, candidate lineups, and recent opinion polls in the key battlegrounds. On today's Wednesday Election Watch, we turn to the Gangwon and Chungcheong provinces. In this vast stretch of land in the north and centre of the nation, voters will choose the governors of Gangwon Province, South Chungcheong Province and North Chungcheong Province, as well as the mayors of Sejong and Daejeon. Two new lawmakers will also fill vacant constituencies in South Chungcheong Province. And as in previous weeks, Seoul-based journalist Andrew Jung is joining us on the line to guide us through the issues dominating the region and the people trying to shape them. Great to have you with us, Mr. Jung.
Hello.
We're also joined today on the line by Dr. Dylan Motan, who is a visiting scholar at the Asia Center at Seoul National University. He'll help us make sense of local voter sentiment and the political dynamics that could determine the outcome of these elections. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Motan.
Very happy to be here.
Well, before we get into the candidates and the region, let's first look at the overall party approval ratings nationwide, with the elections now just around the corner. Mr. Jung, can you walk us through the latest polling numbers?
Sure. The latest weekly polls showed the Democratic Party in a comfortable lead over the main opposition People Power Party and other minor opposition parties. First, we go to the Gallup weekly poll, which showed the Democratic Party enjoying support of 45% from 1,000 adult respondents nationwide. The main conservative party, the People Power Party, enjoyed 23%, while the New Reform Party, a right-leaning minor opposition party, had 4% support, and the Rebuilding Korea Party, a left-leaning party known as the Joguk Hyukshindang here, had 2% support. The poll was conducted Korea-wide from May 12th to May 14th and had a confidence rate of 95%, plus or minus 3.1%. Another poll conducted by Real Meter showed that the Democratic Party had a 45.8% rating, while the People Power Party had a 33.5% rating among 1,003 adults surveyed from May 14th to May 15th. That survey had a 95% confidence level with a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1%.
So far, the DP in a comfortable lead at 2 weeks out from the elections. Let's now turn our focus to Gangwon Province and look at why this region matters. Mr. Jung, tell us what seats are up for grabs and what are the broad political tendencies in this area?
Right. Gangwon tends to lead right. So one of those reasons being that the province borders North Korea. Another reason being that it contains people who descended from those who fled North Korea during that war, among various other reasons. But the Democratic Party has been gaining in the province in the recent decades. The governorship of that province is up for grabs. The mayorships of cities like Gangneung, Sokcho, Chuncheon, and Wonju, they're all up for grabs. Those cities aren't as big as the mega cities outside the province, such as Seoul, Busan, or other metropolitan areas, but still those cities have populations of several hundred thousand people. So those are pretty big cities. The governor race of the province pitting Woo Sang-ho, a Democratic Party member who was a prominent lawmaker and a former senior advisor to the president, Lee Jae-myung, will be challenging the incumbent, a conservative Kim Jin-tae, who's also a former lawmaker and was close to former President Park Geun-hye. So a lot of seats up for grabs, and the most prominent being, of course, the governorship.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Motan, you keep a close eye on the entire country, but you have particular expertise in Gangwon Province, where you were based for 10 years and also earned your PhD from Gangwon National University. Can you please tell our listeners about the political characteristics of this province?
Yes, so the Gangwon province used to be in the past a sort of a swing state, which could go either to the PPP or to the DP direction, but in recent years it has increasingly become a bastion of the PPP, and that is mostly due to aging, because, as you know, older voters tend to vote for PPP, and many young people from Gangwon leave the region to get better opportunities in either Seoul or in Gyeonggi, which are very close nearby. So that is why in 2024, during the general election, the DP suffered a defeat in Gangwon. And actually, during the 2025 presidential election, the PPP candidate, Kim Mun-soo, actually beat Lee Jae-myung in the Gangwon province. So overall, the region has moved to the right, but you have two big cities, Chuncheon, which is the regional capital, and Wonju, which is a big university and university town and a region with a relatively young workforce, which remain DP bastions.
And Dr. Motan, what are the political characteristics of the Chungcheong provinces?
So, first of all, the two Chungcheong regions are not fixed partisan strongholds, unlike a region like Honam or Yeongnam. That tells us that Chungcheong voters will be highly responsive to the national mood beyond the local issues. So, in 2017, the South Korean presidential elections, Moon Jae-in won in Chungcheong. Then the PPP won the two regions in the presidential and local elections of 2022, while the DP made a comeback in 2024 during the general election. And last year, after the martial law disaster for the PPP, you saw Lee Jae-myung get a very clear-cut victory. So that is why it is a bit of a swing state for the Korean politics. If you put together Sejong, North Chungcheong, and South Chungcheong, it represents almost 5 million voters, which is almost 10% of the national electorate. So it really emphasizes the importance of these two regions for the entire Korean political life.
So it sounds like this could be anyone's race in the Chungcheong provinces. And sticking with those provinces, Mr. Jung, tell us about the seats that are up for grabs there.
Yes, the mayorship of Daejeon would be the most prominent race in the province. That city is the largest of the two regions that we're talking about today. It has a population of 1.44 million people, so it's a pretty big city. Next to that, there's the city of Cheongju, which is also pretty big. It has a 850,000 people population, so that's also pretty big. There's also the city of Cheonan. So all those cities will have new mayors or maybe re-electing old mayors. The city of Sejong, a smaller city than the three that we've just talked about, but it is going to be the likely future administrative capital of the country. The president has declared that he wants to exit office from that city. So he sounded pretty determined to move the capital during his term. So there's a lot of big cities in terms of symbolism and population. The governorships of the two provinces are also up for grabs. So, and as we've been discussing, the region is a bit purple. So it's a region that can go both ways. So it will be a nice litmus test of sorts of which party has the upper hand in terms of the national mood this time around.
Well, let's take a bit of a closer look at the candidates. Mr. Jung, of the races that you've just described in the Gangwon and Chungcheong regions, which are drawing the most attention and who are the key candidates?
Right. I think we'd have to focus on the Gangwon province's governorship race, which has turned pretty acrimonious. The two candidates have accused each other of lying and counter-lying, and one guy filed a suit, the other guy filed a counter-suit. So it's been kind of messy. The other major races to watch are obviously the city of Daejeon, which we just talked about. There, the Democratic Party's Daejeon will be challenging the conservative incumbent Lee Jang-woo. In the city of Sejong, The Democratic Party's Chu Sang-ho will be challenging the conservative incumbent there as well. In North Chungcheong, we have Democratic Party's Shin Yong-han, who will be challenging, again, the conservative incumbent. And then in South Chungcheong, we'll have the Democratic Party's Park Soo-hyun, a familiar face to old Korea politics watchers. He's been around for almost 2 decades. He'll be facing off against Kim Tae-hyun, another old face for the Conservative Party. So that South Chungcheong province governor race will also be a match of bigwigs.
Well, Mr. Jung, as you just mentioned, the governor's race in Gangwon province is one of the more closely watched contests in this year's local elections, perhaps in part due to how messy it's gotten. Dr. Montan, what would a win or loss here mean for each party?
So, just to put things into perspective, the Gangwon province is a very small region. It's only 1.5 million people. So the stakes, nationally speaking, are relatively limited. For the DP, losing there would not be such a massive issue because, as we said, the region has long moved to the right. So there wouldn't be too much of a surprise there. The biggest problem of losing would be for the PPP. If they lose in a region where demographics play in their favor, especially if the difference in score happens to be quite significant, it would increase the generational crisis within the party. I think it would also encourage a deep rethinking of the party's identity and of its strategy. It's something we have seen already since 2024, but would get worse if the party suffers a big defeat in a stronghold like Gangwon province. Meanwhile, if somehow it could win this election, it could alleviate the pressure which weighs on the current leadership and of Jong Dong-hyuk.
So it sounds like the PPP has quite a lot at stake in this region. Mr. Jung, what are the key election issues in the region and what are the key pledges of the candidates there?
I think the two candidates are vying for votes from the eastern part of the province because both of these guys, Woo Sang-ho and Kim Jin-tae, hail from Gangwon, Gangwon's western region. So they both have some sort of a base in that part of the province. So they want to eat each other out on the other side of the province. So each candidate has been laying out campaign pledges aimed at getting the votes on the east coast of the province. Woo Sang-ho has promised a AI data center in the province. It's a theme that we've been hearing a lot in this election. He says that that project will bring in 70 trillion Korean won, that's around $50 billion in US dollars. Wu claimed that he had concluded an agreement with a domestic conglomerate, which he has not named, but he would also he also said that he would create an AI valley in the city of Gangneung, a port city in that area with around 200,000 people. Wu has also pledged to galvanize the tourism industry by creating higher-end hotels on the East Coast. Again, Gangneung, Sokcho, those cities are known for tourism. So he's been aiming these promises at that target. Kim Jin-tae, the conservative incumbent who's being challenged by Woo Sang-ho, has challenged Woo Sang-ho to reveal what company that Woo Sang-ho has concluded this AI deal with. Woo Sang-ho has not named any corporation so far. Kim Jin-tae has also pledged to bring in a fire department headquarters to the East Coast, dedicated to that part of the province. He says that that will help make firefighting more efficient. He appears to be trying to address the growing concerns about wildfires in the province. He has also mentioned adopting a provincial pension. Again, that seems to target the older population of the region that Dr. Mota has mentioned. That's a campaign pledge that will need some examination as well, whether that's feasible. Moving on to the city of Daejeon, Lee Jang-woo, the conservative incumbent, has promised a mega golf course in the western end of the city. I don't know why that's the most prominent campaign pledge from his camp, but he's been talking a lot about this purported golf course. He's also promised to create jogging courses along the city's three main creeks, increasing the number of seats at the Daejeon baseball stadium by 3,000. So a lot of questionable campaign pledges, but his opponent, He Tae-jung, has also has been pledging a 1 trillion won city fund, which will be worth around $700 million. So it's a big size that he's been mentioning. He has not said how or where he's going to get the money, but he's made the same pledge in 2021 when he was also running for mayor. And he, at the time, he said that he would use the money by using existing smaller funds and investing that in startups and retrieving that to create this bigger fund. So some campaign pledges from both sides for the city of Taejon that might need some examination.
Dr. Motam, what do voters in Gangwon Province and the Chungcheong provinces, what do they most want to hear from these candidates?
So these two provinces, like most provinces in Korea, have the same problem of how to deal with an aging population, which has to compete with the vortex of Seoul, which attracts many of the young people on a yearly basis. So more specifically for Gangwon, people will want to hear about support for the tourism industry, which is one of the key for the regional economy, and also about the industrial renewal of the eastern and the southern parts of the region, which suffered from the decline of the mining industry in the past decades. There's also the issue of transport infrastructures, which have seen quite a lot of development to try to link the eastern seaboard with the western part of the region and Seoul, but still remain lacking. And the other key issue for Gangwon is North Korea. It's one of the regions of Korea which borders North Korea, and people over there are very sensitive to issues of national security and the overall stability in inter-Korean relations. When it comes to Chungcheong, the issues of public transportation will matter quite a lot, notably in Daejeon. And also, there are competing views about the use of regional currencies, which is something that matters quite a lot for small business owners. And the last big issue is the status of Sejong City, which has been a recurring theme in Korean politics. But Lee Jae-myung has brought back to the table as he promised to move the capital of Korea and his office to Daejeon until 2029, which could really boost the importance of the city and totally alter its economy and, of course, its real estate market, because it would mean that a lot of people would come from Seoul down to the Sejong.
Well, let's now look at where the race stands and break down the data. Mr. Jung, what are the polling numbers showing us at this stage of the race in relation to these provinces?
First, going to the Gangwon governor's race, the biggest of them all, the Democratic Party's Woo Sang-woo, who is running for governor in this province, appears to have the upper hand over his opponent, Kim Jin-tae. A poll conducted by Hankuk Research from May 11th to May 14th showed that 1,200 adult respondents supported Woo Sang-woo by 44.8%, while 32.7% supported Kim Jin-tae. So Woo Sang-woo had a 10% plus advantage there. The confidence level was a 95% with a margin of error of 2.8%. So well above the margin of error there. In Daejeon, the Democratic Party's He Tae-jung had the upper hand in a poll conducted by Korea Research International from May 16th to May 17th, so more recent, which surveyed 800 people in the city. He Tae-jung of the Democratic Party enjoyed a comfortable support of 50% above, above 50%, while Lee Jae-woo had a support rate of 29%. So a pretty hefty margin there. The New Reform Party, the minor opposition conservative party, Kang Il-in, he's an under 30 candidate. He's a former physicist. He was going to graduate school in KAIST, a major university in the area. He was able to garner 1%. So a meaningful I guess, score there, considering that minor opposition parties really don't fare well. But the Democratic Party appears to have the upper hand overall.
And briefly, Dr. Motam, before we wrap up, what do the ruling and opposition parties need to do from here to win these regions?
Starting with Gangwon, I do believe that the Democratic Party might want to talk a bit more about jobs, especially about jobs for older folks, because it's an issue that matters a lot in an aging region. It's an issue that Kim Jin-tae has emphasized quite a lot. For the side of Kim Jin-tae, as you just mentioned, the difference is quite overwhelming, and I don't see what he could do differently to try to bridge this. And coming to the Chungcheong region, since this area is more deeply connected with national issues, the PPP officials might want to position themselves more clearly on general strategy, and especially on how they position themselves regarding the martial law attempt of 2024. Since the region is relatively centrist, you might want to distance yourself from the martial law attempt and Yoon Suk-yeol in order to try to catch these centrist voters, which might still be undecided.
And that's all for this week's Wednesday Election Watch. Our thanks to Seoul-based journalist Andrew Jung for joining us. Thank you so much, Mr. Jung.
Thank you.
And Dr. Dylan Motan of Seoul National University's Asia Center. Thank you for your insights, Dr. Motan.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index shed 62.71 points, or 0.86%, on Wednesday to close at 7,208.95. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 28.29 points, or 2.61%, to close at 1,056.07. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
The Overseas Koreans Agency is holding the 2026 World Conference of Korean Adoptees this week in Incheon, Seoul, and Paju, bringing together adoptees, advocates, organizers, and government officials from around the world. For many participants, the gathering is both personal and political. South Korea sent more than 200,000 children overseas for adoption in the second half of the 20th century, and many adoptees have since raised concerns about abuses, falsified records, and unethical practices. Events like this reflect how the conversation around adoption in Korea has changed from a once taboo subject to an issue of identity, rights, and accountability. And some attendees are returning to Korea for the very first time, while others now live here as foreign residents or citizens. Joining us now on the line from the conference in Seoul is Amanda Cho, a Korean adoptee and policy manager for Adoptees for Justice based in Atlanta, as well as one of the conference leaders. Ms. Cho, welcome to Korea 24.
Hello, thank you so much for inviting us to talk with you.
Ms. Cho, to start, maybe you can tell our listeners about the conference itself, what it's meant to do, why it matters, and what your role is this year as policy manager for Adoptees for Justice.
Yes, sure. So the Overseas Korean Agency has a gathering once a year, and they invite adoptees to participate in this gathering. And this year we have 95 Korean adoptees from all over the world. 14 countries were selected to participate this year, and they've divided us into three groups. So Group A are the leaders, which is the group that I'm participating in. Group B is a group of newcomers who are adoptees who are returning to Korea for the first time since their adoption. And then Group C are speakers, researchers, scholars, those who are here to share their work and their research. And as the policy manager for Adoptees for Justice, I'm here to talk about my role In the US, where we're trying to lobby for legislation that would grant citizenship to all adoptees who are adopted to the United States. And we just want, you know, people to be aware of this issue and to also support us with passing this legislation.
Since you're there in person, could you tell our listeners what the atmosphere has been like so far?
So far, the atmosphere has been really great. There's lots of good energy here. Everyone is very excited to, of course, be in Korea, especially the new people who've never been here before. You know, they're experiencing this all for the first time. And then there's those of us who have been in leadership positions in the adoptee community for years now. So it's kind of like a nice reunion to meet up with other leaders who really from a lot of times we just see each other like on Zoom or we'll talk, you know, on the phone. So it's nice to get together in person and meet people. You know, the venue is very nice. And so that I think helps too. It's a very nice place to be. And it's, you know, very well known. So yeah, we're very excited to be here.
I think those face-to-face interactions make all the difference. Ms. Cho, have you attended this conference before? And if so, how does this year maybe feel similar or perhaps a bit different?
I have actually. So I did attend last year. They had a different structure. They had, last year, it was more two groups. It was the group of newcomers and then the group of leaders, and it was a smaller group. So I participated last year as a leader in that group. And this year, you know, this is my second year attending as a leader. And then I did participate back in 2022 when the gathering was supported by OKF. And that was when I participated, and I also was a speaker. I think this year, the conference or the gathering is has more structure to it. They have more stuff for us to work on. And they actually seem, yeah, it seems like we just have more work to do this year than we did last year.
I want to go back and ask you a little bit more about adoptees who are wanting to return to Korea. As you've touched on, some participants are here in Korea for the very first time, which I imagine is probably a special experience, probably also very emotive. Have you spoken with any first-time returnees, and what has that experience been like for them so far?
Yeah, so far the ones I've spoke with, they are very excited to be here. I think they're taking everything in. They have come from communities where they were the only adoptees and or the only Koreans or Asians. So they're kind of having a little bit of a culture shock being in a country where everyone looks like them. And also not just that, they're with other adoptees too. So it's a lot. So I think they're just slowly taking things in and processing it. I think they do feel happy to be here, you know, with other adoptees. I know my first time returning to Korea was also attending a large Korean adoptee conference. And I think I took all of that in too, so I can see that, you know, it's good to be experiencing all of this when you have other people who understand what you've been through. You know, there's also a lot of emotions too, you know, that come with it. So they're also trying to, you know, I guess deal with those emotions, whether, you know, they may show them publicly in front of everyone or maybe retreat back to their room, or maybe the emotions will hit after they return back to their homes after the gathering.
Well, I think some of those personal experiences that you've just touched on, you know, they point, of course, to some broader practical challenges. A lot of organizations at the conference work on issues like family searches and records access and helping adoptees who want to return to Korea and live in Korea. Ms. Cho, could you tell us what are some of the biggest obstacles that adoptees face when they try to reconnect with Korea or even move here?
Sure. Yeah. So there are so many obstacles. I think first it depends on the reason you're moving to Korea, everybody has a different reason, or they're looking for something different. But whether it's, you know, you want to reunite with your birth family, and so there can be obstacles there, because like there could be a language barrier. That's always very difficult. I'm also in reunion with my birth family, and we have a difficult time communicating. So that's definitely like probably one of the largest obstacles that you'll experience here, if you don't speak Korean. There's like trying to like integrate into the social and cultural norms of Korea, is difficult because you weren't raised, you know, in that culture. And so, so knowing when to speak up, or, you know, how to speak to, you know, like the elderly community or something, or any community, like what are the norms? So that's an obstacle. I think also those who want to be here long term have expressed challenges with finding jobs here. There's just not a lot of opportunities for foreigners, you know, to find good jobs here. So that's an obstacle. But yeah, and also just like family dynamics too, like, you know, reuniting with your birth family, you know, can be a wonderful experience, but there's a lot of challenges that come along with that too. Mm-hmm. In dealing with that emotional and mental, you know, experience can be a lot.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Cho, what do you hope it achieves by the end of the week?
Yeah, so I think everyone's going to have a different experience here. But I think at the end, I just want the community of adoptees to know that that they're not alone, that there is a community out there, that, you know, there are organizations, there are resources for them. What brought them here, everyone came here for different reasons. So, you know, I hope that whatever they came here for, they were able to achieve that. But at the end, you know, at the end of the week, I just hope that, you know, they will continue, you know, to engage with the adoptee community, you know, at a wider, broader, you know, experience, and want to come back with us and want to contribute to the organizations and help build them. We do have an ICA gathering, and ICA is the International Korean Adoptee Associations. So that's an association that has a gathering. It is adoptee-led. They have it every 3 years in Korea, and they invite adoptees from all over the world to come. And we do have that in October. So I really hope that the adoptees who are attending this week will want to come back in October and spend time with us. I just hope that whatever they came here hoping for, that they were able to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. We hope the same for them, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to wrap up our conversation today. Amanda Cho, Policy Manager for Adoptees for Justice, joining us from the 2026 World Conference of Korean Adoptees. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your perspective with us.
Thank you.
It's time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. And in the studio with us today is Julia Ratti, a translator from Korean into Italian and English, and my favourite Italian contributor on our show. Julia, hello and welcome back.
Hello, Alana. I can't believe this is already my first time on the show.
Right, four times already. Time is flying by. Well, of course, we're very, very happy to have you. I have a feeling today's pick might be another Cho Ye-un book. Am I right?
What makes you think that? Well, yes, you're right. Welcome back to the horror corner. Today, I'm introducing you to the second novel of my favorite Korean author. This is Teddy Bears Never Die, which was published in Korean with the title Teddy Bear Chukji Ana in 2023 for An Jung Gauk. The English publisher is Wildfire, and the translator is the amazing Song Yu. I hope there are a lot of Cho Ye-un fans listening today. because they would be elated to learn that soon we'll have not one but two novels by Cho Yeon in our hands. One is Shift, which I introduced last time I was on the show, and the other one is, of course, Teddy Bears Never Die, which will come out on May 26th.
So definitely a super exciting month for her English-speaking fans. Now, Julie, of course, we did touch on Cho Yeon last time you were with us, but could you give us a brief refresher of exactly who this author is?
Of course. So Cho Yeon is an award-winning South Korean writer. Her genre-defying fiction blends horror, romance, thriller, and science fiction. She studied metal craft in university, which is an interesting choice, I would say, considering her career of choice, and made her literary debut in 2016. She has since authored over 10 books, including 7 novels and novellas. The English edition of New Seoul Park, Jelly Vendor Massacre, has been published by Hon for Star, along with Shift, both translated by Yewon Jung. Some of her books are slated for screen adaptation, and Overlap Knife Knife has already been adapted into a miniseries for KBS.
Certainly a helpful reminder of, you know, just how wide-ranging her work is, from, as you mentioned, horror and sci-fi to romance and thriller, and now increasingly beyond the page as well. Let's now turn to this new book. Without, of course, giving us too many spoilers, what is the plot of Teddy Bears Never Die?
Okay, so the story is set in the coastal city of Yamu, where an orphan teenage girl called Hwayoung wants to avenge her mother. Hwayoung lives in a rundown apartment with other children who survive by committing petty crimes, sometimes at the request of their landlord, Youngjin, who forces his tenants to act as bait for his black market operations. Hwayoung manages to stay out of it until she's fired from her part-time job. And at that point, left with no other choice, she complies with Youngjin's demands, but too late realizes that the buyer she's about to meet isn't interested in purchasing illegal drugs, as she was told. Instead, he's there to kill her. So Hwayoung fights back, but can only escape with the help of a sentient teddy bear, like an actual plushie, whose axe-wielding skills leave the guy wounded enough for both Hwayoung and the teddy bear to escape. Through this unlikely friendship, we uncover Hwayoung's past. Her mother died 3 years prior during a mass poisoning that rocked the city's most exclusive apartment complex, except that Hwayoung doesn't believe that her mother was poisoned. She thinks her mother's boss, the former mayor, killed her. And to avenge her, Hwayoung is hustling to save up enough money to hire an assassin.
Okay, definitely quite an opening. Part revenge thriller, part social horror. I was following along and then suddenly there was an axe-wielding teddy bear in the mix. But beneath that surreal premise, it does sound like the novel is also dealing with, you know, very serious topics like grief and exploitation and a young girl trying to survive in a city that has really failed her. Certainly a thrilling start.
Oh yeah, and it gets better. So the soul inhabiting the teddy bear that repeatedly saves Hwayoung is Doha, a former friend of Hayoung's, who also happens to be the former mayor's nephew. So after Doha's parents and cousin die in the same mass poisoning, the mayor adopts Doha. Despite his blood ties with the mayor, Doha puts his friendship first and decides to help Hwayoung. Doha basically suspects that his uncle had some unclear ulterior motives in adopting him. And it turns out he's actually right to be suspicious, because when he and Hwayoung arrives at his house, they find a second Doha waiting for them.
Okay, very intriguing and wonderfully spooky, you know, very Cho Yeon, as we've discussed before. Just when it sounds like a revenge story with a supernatural sidekick, the novel adds another layer of mystery with the question of who or what the second Doha really is.
Oh yeah, it is quite spooky. And I haven't even touched on the role ghosts play in this book. So you see, basically Doha descends from a line of shamans. He can see the dead. And it's thanks to him that Hwayoung can unravel the mystery behind her mother's death and the sinister events lurking underneath the shiny facade of that fancy apartment complex. just from this brief synopsis, you can see that a lot of different themes are woven into the novel.
Absolutely. Even from that setup, there's clearly a lot going on beneath the supernatural threads. We have ghosts, we have shamanism, we have class divides, corruption, grief and revenge all tangled together. Let's go back to the themes for a quick moment. Julia, what would you say are the main themes Choyeon is exploring in Teddy Bears Never Die?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say that the power of friendship has a huge part to play here. Unlike the New Seoul Park Jelly Massacre, which featured different characters in each chapter, Teddy Bears Never Die focuses on two characters only, showing how their companionship evolves. The horror concept and gore scenes are much more fleshed out than her earlier books, especially because the author introduces a very interesting depiction of evil and how it presents itself in the real world. Cho also expands on her previous themes of grief, as you said, capitalism and class inequality, and delves deep into the darkest corners of the human heart, depicting the vulnerability of poor, marginalized children, which was also a theme in Shift, as well as the cruelty and greed of adults. But then compared to Shift, though, these avarice of that adults show in her book isn't limited to money and power. It also includes cold-blooded murder. So we're like one step above, basically. However, that's not to say that Choyeon's brand of cute and creepy isn't present. On the contrary, the story has a wicked sense of humor. Like, there were actually parts that I was, like, kind of laughing out loud. And the friendship between the two main characters, as I said, is also so tender and heartwarming.
Well, that contrast is certainly striking. And the novel goes into some, as you've discussed, very dark territory, but still hold on to that tenderness and offbeat humour that Choyeon is famous for. It's interesting also to hear that the horror isn't just supernatural, but also rooted in very real forms of inequality and cruelty. Before we wrap up today's Korea Book Club, is there anything else you'd like to mention about your favourite author?
Well, I would actually want to talk about the translator, Song Yoo, because she has done a terrific job. The narration reads flawlessly. She managed to keep some of the tongue-in-cheek jokes of the Korean novel and the way she describes the teddy bear while preserving the Korean onomatopoeia is honestly amazing. Actually, can I read a few lines from the prologue? I asked if I could read a few lines on the radio for
please,
this.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. All 17 years old Hwang Hwa-young can do right now is to seize money, the new god and the mightiest weapon of our age. Money works miracles. A story that starts with money can only end with it. That's what Hwa-young believes, an important lesson someone once taught her. But a weapon that isn't lodged in another's flesh is a weapon that can always wound you, unless you were born holding one. You'll need to sell your soul at the very least just to grasp the handle.
A powerful passage, and it really hints at the mix of danger and wit running through the novel. It's also lovely, I think, to hear how much care has gone into the translation. Julie, did anything else stand out to you about Teddy Bears Never Die?
I am a very much, I am a translator very much obsessed with covers, so I'm going to talk about the cover. And so first of all, the artist is Andy Bourne, and the design credit is Anna Goldfinch. And I actually went to see, to check out Andy's Instagram account, and I was really amazed and left in awe because all his works have such vibrant colors. It's really interesting. And anyway, back to Teddy Bears Never Die. As you can see, the illustration features a gigantic teddy bear with a girl on his shoulder, which is a fun take on the story itself because, like, throughout the book, it's Doha, the teddy bear, riding on Hwa-young's shoulder as they escape all kinds of dangerous adventures by a hair's breadth. Unlike the covers of Shift and the New Seoul Jelly Park Massacre with their toned-down pastel colors, this one is very bright with lots of yellows and like a shock of pink. I think it also fits the humorous undertones of the novel, but don't be fooled. Like, this book is actually very, very dark.
Okay, so a bright cover, a dark story, and again, an axe-wielding teddy bear. It sounds like Teddy Bears Never Die is just overall very much a Cho Yeon novel. And so for listeners who enjoy horror with humour, heart and a sharp social edge, this is definitely one to look out for when it does come out in English on May 26th. Julia Rotty, thank you so much for joining us again on today's Korea Book Club.
Thank you, and see you soon.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. Don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. We've got more stories, interviews and insights you won't want to miss. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thanks for joining me. Take care and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.